Discovering a new experience, one that enriches your sense of self and of possibilities, can be a gift. Being told about a new book, one that's thoughtful, beautifully written, on expansive themes, likewise can be a gift. That is true even if the themes illuminate the limited sense of possibilities for fictional characters you grow to care about. I've found such gifts on occasion in the recommendations by our book moles, Larry Bolden and Matt Witt. Now, I'd like to offer you such a gift in the form of a novel that captivated me. The novel is The Great Offshore Grounds. Its author, Vanessa Veselka, is a Portland writer with a wide range of work experience and acute class and gender sensibilities. To give you some glimpses of Veselka's thoughtfulness and craft, Patricia will read some passages as I tell you more. This is a book about location and direction, about where we are, where we're going, and if we even know where we are and where we're going, or really know where we've come from. It's about the precariousness of our lives and the limits of our self-knowledge. It uses dead reckoning, a nautical phrase, as metaphor for our place in the world. Dead reckoning is what sailors use when they have no other means of establishing their position than through vague knowledge of where they started and how long it might have taken them to get to wherever they might be. Time, too, is a theme in this book. And nautical experience, the work done aboard ships, is more than metaphor here.
The problem of location has never been simple. Do you fix a point and aim at wherever you want to go? Or do you locate yourself in relation to the shore, memory, and landmarks? Baleen whales navigate this way. Toothed whales do not. Early sailors preferred celestial navigation, best to rely on something outside the grasp of this world. But celestial navigation doesn't solve the problem of unknown shores and cloud cover, which is why dead reckoning is the fallback of sailors, a fixed beginning, speed, and trajectory. Dead reckoning is how wolves cross snowy hillsides, how pumas slip between desert ridges in the night. Out of satellite range in open ocean without lighthouse beacon or buoy, dead reckoning is a sailor's final hope. But solve one problem, and it has puppies. Give a man a fish, and it's not his fault. But teach a man to fish, and he eats everything in the ocean. Starting point, mode of transport, goal.
Work, too, is a theme, not only on ships, but driving a cab or as a security guard, with vivid descriptions that take us inside the experience. And the we I alluded to as living precarious lives is working class. As I said, this is a novel keenly attuned to class and also gender. Of the four main characters, three are women, two sisters, and the woman who raised them. The fourth, a boy from the streets adopted into their little family years ago as a teenager, has an important but lesser role. For me, the account of cab driving, the interactions among the drivers of various races and nationalities, the drivers' differing motivations, all that was a revelation. Reading of those work-related passages would take too long, but here are a couple of quick accounts of the humiliations of searching for a job. First, for one of the sisters.
At 5 o'clock, people started leaving the temp office. At a quarter after, the associate placement counselor called Cheyenne back into the administrative catacombs. The associate sat her down, reviewed her clipboard, and told Cheyenne she had a wonderful future in servitude, if she had the right outlook, which she didn't. Cheyenne made it through with her eager face on, though barely. The counselor congratulated her on her wealth of hard-won but unrelated skills. We'll call you for sure. Meanwhile, get some slacks.
And then, for the woman who raised the sisters.
She closed the nickel ads. If you were over 25 and looking for a job, everyone expected a pageant of humiliation and a good story. Are you a recovering addict? Are you married to a bride hoarder? Are you a homemaker new to the market with an autistic son or a husband with cancer? Tell me. No, tell me. What exactly is your excuse for being 52 and broke?
From the very first page, the explicit context is capitalism, both as it has developed historically and in the strange, if equally exploitive form it takes in the present. The book begins with a wedding set at a lighthouse on an island offshore from Seattle. Immediately, Veselka situates the participants in a class structure, from the rich guests to the poor relatives to the people preparing the food and servicing the grounds. She works in some of the backstory of the lighthouse, its 19th century origins, as she says, at the dawn of massive capital expansion and speculation, and the toll it took on the worker who had to shovel tons of coal to keep it lit. The super wealthy bridegroom is the biological father of the two grown-up sisters. What Veselka says about him from the sister's perspective is also a way to characterize modern capitalism.
They had not followed his career. When he lost interest in them, they lost interest in him. Still, they knew the broad strokes. He had started in software development. Rich in stock, he had branched out into sidelines, like the import-export business that employed the Tibetans. From there, it was less concrete. He had, it seemed, transcended goods and services almost entirely, diversifying into multiple shell companies, replicating and mirroring, acquiring and sloughing off, unmoored from states of reality like warehouses and people, to become an algorithmic superstructure of predatory capital, ever-moving, ever-present, unfixable in space and time.
The perspective throughout is working class. An underlying question as the characters travel through the country is, to whom does this country belong? The sisters and brother cross the country by car, as well as by plane, and by ship along the entire West Coast and beyond. The author beautifully integrates descriptions of nature and landscape with history, flashes of psychological insight, and her own reflections on life.
He walked on the thin dirt footpath along an arterial road between bushes and intermittent guardrails, every passing car spraying him with water. It went on like this for a mile. Not all miles are the same. The mile between you and digging a ditch is shorter than the one between you and the body of someone you love. And that mile is different from the one between you and the person who needs money as much as you do that you can't pay back. The mile he was walking felt like a combination of all three.
Or another.
Then they came to the Great Powder River, which was fed by the Little Powder as well as oil from pipeline breaks, Red Cloud's War, and benzene as it joined the Yellowstone. The Yellowstone, which already had inherited so much, the Bighorn and the Wind and the Tongue, as it flowed toward the Missouri River, which had no choice but to inherit the watershed as it drained toward the Mississippi, that unstoppable force. And maybe there just is no way out of history, no matter how much you want to come from a different story. You can't.
This is the story of a quest for origins, for identity. It is a quest based on a myth, as many literary and real-life quests are. In this case, it's a myth told by a mother figure to two young girls, born on the same day, raised together. The girls interpret the quest differently and respond to it each in her own way. They pull together and pull apart. They each find different answers and only partial resolution. There is no neat ending here, but more self-knowledge than when they began.
Having an organizing myth is good. This had been her thinking. Myths give heroic shape to adolescence in a time devoid of initiation. The story was supposed to free them from the mundane. It was a condom to lower the risk of spiritually transmitted diseases like monogamy and patriarchy. But to have power, myths need drama. They need transcendent beauty. And in the ugly blocks of subsidized housing, surrounded by fast food chains, penned in by arterial roads without sidewalks, over that year when they had moved from one dismal apartment without natural light to the next, always with black mold blooming on walls punched with jacks for cable you can't afford to use, how was she supposed to give them that? And in order for them to work, myths require initiation, and initiation requires profound emotional confusion. You need to lose something you hold dear, something you thought made you what you were. That's the price of entry.
Not only is this an engaging, well-constructed novel, but the line-by-line writing is felicitous and sometimes exceptional. The author's insights and reflections are worth pausing over and pondering. The facts and details she provides with considerable expertise support her work-oriented, working-class point of view. She adds two fruitful devices I haven't yet mentioned. In one of them, historical characters, like Sir Walter Raleigh, in full period regalia, show up in a kind of hallucinatory magic realism to remind us that our threads of colonialism and imperialism run deep. In another, she uses occasional italicized passages as a kind of commentary on or deepening of her character's own thinking, sometimes as if they were able to step back and reflect on their lives or situations in ways she otherwise shows them less able. So this is my gift to you on today's Old Mole. The book is The Great Offshore Grounds by Vanessa Veselka. And this is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour.